Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Wave podcast. Today on the show, I've got Dave Birnbaum of Coinbits. Dave is an awesome guy, had some really good takes on the financialization of Bitcoin. We talked about 2024 and what a big year it was for Bitcoin and for Bitcoiners. Lots of interesting stuff here, self-custody, you name it. I think we covered it. I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. Hey everyone, like I said in the intro, I've got Dave here. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate being here. I'm excited to talk to you today.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this conversation. So you are a rather prolific writer and have contributed to Forbes, their digital assets segments on many occasions. And I was doing my research going through and a lot more articles from you than I think I'd even realized. Before we jump into a couple of those that I'd like to highlight, could you just share with me, how did you get that gig? How do you become like a contributor to Forbes?
You know what? This all started. So a little bit background on how I got there is, so I lead product and marketing for Coinbits, which is the oldest US-based Bitcoin-only exchange still in operation. So we launched back in 2018. We're still going. We're family-owned and operated. We've never taken VC or an investment money and kind of grown us sustainably. And so there's kind of two sides to that. One side is we haven't experienced that like hyper growth that would have made us a household name. But on the other hand, we have a really loyal user base that is, has been using us for years to accumulate Bitcoin. You know, we've distributed hundreds of millions of dollars worth of Bitcoin at this point to people over the years. And so we really take pride in sort of serving people's ability to get on Bitcoin. Our original mission was to help grandma get Bitcoin, right? And I think that we've been an important part of that story. And a couple of years ago, we were talking about growing and talking about our marketing strategy. At the time, I was really focused only on product, and we realized that, most startups will take all their resources and invest in marketing and sell something that they haven't built yet, and then go build it. And be panicked by the fact that they have no funding to actually build the thing they promised. That's the standard way of doing things. We did the opposite, which is perhaps not much better. We built a really robust product with features for Bitcoin roundups and recurring buys and self-custody. And so it's actually very full-featured, and in fact, even more so compared to some of the guys that you might have heard of. But we didn't do very much marketing at all. So, since we haven't taken, investor money, we don't have the resources to go out and just spray messaging out through marketing channels. And I've always enjoyed writing, and I, talking with the team, we were just like, you know what, if we could get some well-placed, PR, then, that would be really high leverage. Like, why don't we start talking to the friends that we have who work in media and see if we can get some articles about Coinbits placed. So that was sort of the beginning. And that's what resulted in me kind of reaching out to a lot of these media outlets. At this point, though, I realized that I really enjoy kind of the thinking about both the news and also like kind of strategically like what Bitcoin is and where it's going. And I've sort of as maybe a side gig or a hobby, I've taken on this role, and Forbes is just one of them. I also write for Bitcoin Magazine. I've written for Bitcoin News. I write for some economics outlets like the Foundation for Economic Education, the American Institute for Economic Research. So I enjoy kind of pulling these threads together, and it really gives me as a product person that context, right? So, you can get really, when you're working in product, you can kind of start to get blinders because you're so focused on the product market fit of what you're building and the unit economics of that, and, meeting with users, and they're giving you really valuable information sort of in the moment about what they're experiencing. And so you go and iterate on that product. But you have to make sure, as they say, that as you climb the ladder of success, that you your ladder is leaning against the right wall, right? So I've found that writing is something that gives me that confidence that I have that broader context and what is going on macroeconomically, politically, and so on, and how Bitcoin fits in that. And then, and it's just fun, but that also gives us sort of that strategic view of like, okay, well, what's coming down? And we can talk about what I see coming down the pike in 2025 and beyond for Bitcoin, in terms of like product opportunities and what people are going to actually be using Bitcoin for. But yeah, that's kind of the background. And I guess the Forbes thing, I've been writing for them a couple of years, Forbes.com. And, you know, it's again, it's something where if something interesting happens in the news, I'm able to go kind of run to my keyboard and write an article about it and make sure that, you know, I'm unabashedly a Bitcoin maximalist and maybe one of the only ones who write for Forbes.com with that perspective. And so, you know, I think I'm able to present the news through the lens of, you know, the way that you or I might interpret events. And that might be different from crypto people and finance people. So yeah, I hope it's moving the needle just a little bit.
Yeah, no, I think it must be. Hopefully, you know, over the coming years, there are 10 of you contributing to Forbes with, you know, similar philosophical outlooks, even if opinions may differ, you know, when it comes to the nuance. So let's talk about one of those articles. So you wrote an article, I guess it came out the end of 2024, and what a year it was for Bitcoin. So you talked about, you know, the announcement of the strategic Bitcoin reserve or the potential for that, ETFs, all of these things. For you, what was the most defining moment of 2024 for Bitcoin? And what do you think its implications are as we head into 2025?
Yeah, so 2024 was extraordinary because if you had asked me in the first quarter, the second quarter, third and fourth, it's like it built. So like, you know, it was almost like there were big moments that overwrote the previous big moment because the new big moment was even bigger. In retrospect, the biggest moment was, I would have to say it was the appearance of Donald Trump at Bitcoin Nashville, because there's just no way anymore that you can say that Bitcoin is some kind of fringe movement. Like it's a presidential talking point. It was something that that I think cost the Harris campaign when they refused the invitation to come to Bitcoin Nashville, and that may not be for the better. Honestly, we'll see how it plays out. But you know, it could be that it would have been better if this had remained a bipartisan issue in the United States. But in some sense, it was destined to just become partisan because everything we do here is partisan lately. And so if of any issue, it's just like, you know, one side picks up the mantle and the other side denigrates. And so maybe it was destined to happen. But the fact that you had not only mainstream presidential candidates. So like, for example, I think I might have written an article earlier about RFK Jr. And I was excited that a quote unquote mainstream presidential candidate was talking about Bitcoin, because that's a big deal by itself, even though he was sort of a third candidate. For me, I was like, wow, that's really moving the needle. And then to have it taken up by one of the two front runners and the one who won the election, announcing the intention to unwind Operation Choke Point 2.0, which was an unjust and probably almost certainly illegal attack on the Bitcoin industry. And like, this will change everything. So, I mean, I don't know what you feel as somebody who also works in the industry, but I have found not only more inbound interest, but just sort of a general mood shift or vibe shift. And there are people who maybe there's like different classes of people. There's people who beginning of 2024, they might have been Bitcoiners, but they thought of it as being maybe too risky to talk about. And now they're more comfortable talking about it because we're in an era where you're more free to speak and not pay a price for that. Then there's people who are coming around to Bitcoin, which is fascinating to watch as well. You see people, I mean, you could call them bandwagoners, right? But that's fine. We'll take it. We need everybody that we can get. And so you have some like TradFi people. again, the ETFs came out, it's hard to remember, the ETFs came out in February. That was going to be the big news of 2024. And that was like not even close to the biggest news. But that resulted in a lot more sort of mainstream finance. You had Bitcoin being talked about, on mainstream sort of financial channels, Bloomberg, CNBC, and so on. So it's a sea change. And so I think that the situation we're in 2025 is we have these stragglers and these naysayers who still are, you know, like lost cause activists who don't want to see Bitcoin succeed or want to try to prevent it from succeeding through the force of law, regulation, negative media and so on. But they're just so on the wane in terms of influence. I don't even think that's really an issue. I think 2025 is a year that all of us, you, Bitcoin Way, your company, Coinbits, my company, all throughout the industry, the question is going to be whether the values of Bitcoin that are sort of embedded in the protocol are able to be transmitted all the way to the end user, or whether only people higher in the sort of custody stack are able to benefit from those values, and people in lower in the custody stack are going to have to rely on counterparty risk in order to own and use Bitcoin. So we can get into that. I think custody and innovative approaches to custody are going to be key in 2025.
What would your prediction for that be? Because my assumption for a long time has been the earlier you are, the more likely you are to own and hold UTXOs, to have the ability to fully self-custody. And at some point, it seems likely, whether optimal or not, that people are going to take on counterparty risk when they're buying, earning in Bitcoin, for example, right? Like something like Lightning or a layer two might be some sort of custodial solution or semi-custodial solution might be the option or the convenient option. Because I think part of it too is not just, it's not just a technical challenge, but a philosophical challenge. Most people aren't like us that they crave this self-sovereignty. They're very accustomed to banks. Like we've sort of unwound from that legacy mindset. Most people haven't. What would you anticipate this looking like if you were just to speculate and pull out your crystal ball here?
Yeah. So things change. People change. It's like, comment on X for people to be like, nothing ever happens. But things are happening and things change. I mean, think about it this way. The change in attitudes towards free speech or even gun ownership, I think that, the Second Amendment is something I think a lot about with in relation to Bitcoin, because it's, a decentralized technology that enables people to remain sovereign in their physical being versus financial. And so I wonder whether there will be a change in attitude, especially if there are sort of these black swan events. Like, imagine if Bitcoin, if there's a major custodian, for some of these financial products for Bitcoin that like loses their keys or, something really disastrous to put a dent in the overall supply of accessible Bitcoin. It could be that people, if you have that sort of news and then you also have solutions, you need the solutions too. The problem is people haven't had solutions, and actually they still don't have great solutions. I do think people want to own UTXOs. I think that the problem with fees and the cost associated with ownership are we talk about it too, like as if it's a bigger deal than it is, at least in developed economies. Sure, for medium of exchange, you're going to have an issue, but for people's wealth, if we see a wholesale transition away from, for example, real estate being one of the primary, if not the primary store of value in the United States, toward Bitcoin, people will pay to own a UDXO, and they'll pay for help with sovereign custody. It's expensive to do a real estate transaction, and it's incredibly illiquid. And so people put up with a lot for store of value. They'll put up with a lot of inconvenience and cost. And so, I don't see an issue there. I think that if there is like an understanding that like Bitcoin UDXOs are a primary store of value, people will go figure it out and use it. Custody, yes, that's still an issue. So like you might have seen this article. You definitely saw it. The article about the California fires, right? So, it got me thinking as I'm watching these people just going through hell, quite literally, that they are picking up the pieces of their life. And there are definitely people there, although I haven't heard any stories directly, right? But there are definitely people there who are terrified by the fact that somewhere in this pile of rubble, there's this metal plate containing $1 million, and they don't know if they're ever gonna find it. And if they do need to go find it, they're gonna have to like dig through glass and metal and toxic fumes and, you know, maybe find it and maybe not, or maybe looters already found it, or maybe emergency crews don't let them get to their house because it's too dangerous, or it's just bureaucratic red tape. Whatever the case may be, people have maybe it made me realize, me included, that metal plates are important, but they're not the be-all and end-all, because even if you can shoot them with rifles and put them in acid, all the different tests that people do to kind of like make sure they work, in a disaster, there's a lot more going on than just sort of the physical trials of the metal plate. And you know, that's probably not going to work for most people, maybe for part of their wealth, but you can't expect people to be okay with being like ruined in that way. It's interesting though, because like a lot of people have lost their house and they may not have had that insured. And so that's sort of like the same thing. It's like you had this asset that was in one place at one time in the world, and it had a physical disaster befall it, and now a huge amount of your net worth is wiped out and you actually have no recourse at all. So on some level, it's like, well, you know, single sig metal plate backups are not that dissimilar from real estate as a store of value in some ways. Both are very, very vulnerable. But you can supposedly, at least in some parts of the country, still get fire insurance and so on. And so we need the types of products that make that preserve sovereignty, but then also have are robust to sort of localized disasters. And so actually I would like to ask you, like, I know that you think about this a lot. What do you think about how do you think about custody in 2025? Like what type, is there anything new in terms of multi-sig that we need to be educating people about?
We think about custody a lot. I think what people need to be vigilant about are the scenarios. And I'm actually working on an article. We're going to have like a PDF available on our website here in the next couple of weeks. In light of the fires, is just, you know, an obvious example. I think you can leverage a robust single sig with a passphrase. I think there are the right ways to do this, but people need to think very diligently on what am I doing to protect these data pieces that I need if I need to recover my funds. And at the Bitcoin way, we don't believe the solution is a third party service provider. I'll take myself for example. I have a small handful of people in my life, some geographically, you know, dispersed around the country, who I trust fully. And if I, you know, kept a redundant backup of my seed plate with them, I have complete confidence that they're not going to move it. They're not going to tell someone that they're storing it, right? And so I think most people probably have that sort of arrangement. I think if you're more technically competent, I think moving to something like a multi-sig can be a great idea. I think the average person coming into Bitcoin in, you know, 2025, that's something they're going to need to graduate to. And so starting off with a robust single sig with a passphrase where you have a very solid game plan for disaster recovery. Because you're right, like people who lost their house, the good, you know, good luck finding that in the rubble. Or if you live in a, you know, I live in St. Louis, we have, you know, tornado warnings from time to time. It's like, if that hits my house, where did my seed plate go? You know, like you need to think those things through. So from a technical level, there's nothing in 2025 that I'm keeping an eye on at the moment that I think is going to revolutionize self-custody. But I think what a lot of people fail, and now I'm just sort of going on a tangent, but what a lot of people fail to recognize is that even using like a collaborative custody arrangement, you think that you're now in I can lose my seed phrase. Most people don't realize, though, that there are other risks to engaging with a counterparty. Like if they go under, if there's regulatory capture, you're still, now you're back to single sig. You have to have the config file. You have to have all of the instructions, you know, the documented to be able to go get a Linux computer, plug this stuff into the command line. It's like, now it's even harder, yeah. Right? And a lot of people, I think, just fail to understand. They fail to parse through the marketing of any of these options that are on the market and realize that at the end of the day, you're sacrificing something for convenience if you're sharing a key with a third party. And if you do 100% self-custody right, you can mitigate against a lot of those primary concerns, I guess. That's maybe a summary of my position.
Yeah, that makes sense. Actually, I mean, in conversations with you guys, it really opened my mind to this, right? So, for example, you always think worst case scenario with this stuff. And, you know, if you have a collaborative custody solution where you have a regulated entity holding a key, they can't move your Bitcoin without your permission. That's fine. So it's not like a controlling quorum. But, you know, life is long, as they say, and a lot can happen. And there's a lot of ruin in a nation, and a lot of weird stuff can happen politically. And if that company comes under pressure to hand over KYC information from their customers to some agency that controls, you know, hard power, like force against people, and they want to come and go to all the people that this collaborative custodian has onboarded and basically say, we know you have this much Bitcoin, you need to hand it over. I mean, you could just retreat to this concept of like, well, you don't have to hand it over because it's Bitcoin. You could destroy your own private key and they'll never get it. Fine. But practically speaking, you don't want to go through that. And you don't have to if you don't use a collaborative custodian. So, I mean, I'm sort of starting to realize that, and I wonder what you think about this. Like, you know, there's people who could benefit from Bitcoin who, like, it's a vibrant society with lots of different types of people in it, right? There's people who have, or maybe lower functioning people, right? And they can't do that. Or there's the possibility of a head injury where you forget your passphrase. And it's like, well, you should have written it down in this and that. I understand that, but not everybody will do everything properly. So it's a really tough problem that that I think needs to solve. But maybe what it is there's a certain amount of Bitcoin that you own. If it is KYC'd Bitcoin, and we should talk about what KYC'd Bitcoin really is, because it's not just the Bitcoin that's KYC, it's the amount that you own, which is a little bit different. But anyway, so you have some amount of Bitcoin that you own that the government has a record of you owning, and then maybe you have another amount of Bitcoin that they don't, and that's completely legal. And in fact, you know, I don't want anybody to think I'm advocating anything wrong. That is completely natural and legal to have a private amount of wealth and to transact completely privately. So you have some amount like that, and then that you never expose that to any kind of collaborative custody or counterparty at all, except for maybe in your, like you said, your trust network of like very, very close friends and family. And then the KYC stuff, though, which very well may be the lion's share of what you own. And let's face it, the possibility of like men with guns coming to your door is quite low, I think, at least at this point. Maybe I wouldn't have said the same thing 2 years ago. But like, So that shows you how fast things can change. But, but maybe we over optimize for paranoia and then freeze people in their ability to make decisions. Like, I kind of do worry about that. Like, I think, and you can tell me what you think, but I think when we're orange pilling people, if the only way to get you started on your journey is to get you into a collaborative custody arrangement where you feel comfortable because you did your own research and you like that, maybe that's okay. Maybe that's better than not doing anything. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's certainly a step in the right direction. I mean, if you leave your coins on an exchange, you don't have the keys. You have no control. I mean, we get emails from people all the time. Coinbase, Robinhood, they're not letting me withdraw. I mean, I'm they're just trying to pay an invoice, and we're battling with the exchange. So I definitely think it's better. I think it's just important that people understand what they're getting into, because if a collaborative custody solution fails in some way, you're effectively in self-custody then. But instead of just punching your seed phrase and a passphrase into a new hardware wallet, you've got to go figure out, if you're 65 years old and not very, technically competent, for you to go figure out how to recover, that's going to be very difficult. For you to punch in 24, 25 words into a hardware wallet, very straightforward. And that's something that we help people with all the time is, hardware wallet recoveries. I think for me, I think of it like this way. My belief about trust is sort of how I feel about government policy. And that is, if you're building a house, I don't want a bunch of federal government regulations dictating what I can and can't do with my home, right? Like, they're so far removed from that. For them to try making that call is tyranny. But if I live in a subdivision and I want to, make a modification to my home, and the HOA says, no, that's going to look horrible. All my neighbors are going to hate it. In this small community, you can decide those things together and agree upon those things and make those determinations. And I feel the same way with trust. I don't want to trust the Federal Reserve. And then I also don't want to trust a state chartered bank. And then I also don't want to trust some third party collaborative custody provider. I want to trust my brother, right? Like, I want to trust myself. Like, if I can keep that trust closer to home, I'm going to be much better off. It's just important, to my earlier point, I think, that people just think strategically about it. Like, what are the scenarios that could come up? What if I live on the same property as my brother? We bought land together and built houses.
Oh, cool.
If a tornado comes through my house, it's probably going through his house too, or he's going to have damage. I don't know if a seed plate at both of those places is the best idea, right? But one of my best friends in Chicago. Okay, that might be, a better idea. Probably unlikely he's going to get hit with a tornado at the same time, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's thinking through all of these things. And that's this article I'm trying to write is, giving people those considerations. What are the worst case, scenarios that you might face, and act accordingly. So that's my thought. Go on.
No. I had this revelation a couple of years ago about this, which is, in the real world, at the very base layer of reality, somebody has to be trusted with custody of anything. So, like, I think we forget, I think not we, but I think a lot of people forget that, because they're like, it's like banks also are responsible for not losing stuff. Like, there's passwords that they can't lose. Custodians, like, these prime custodians for the ETFs and so on. Somebody has to do it. And so you can either do it yourself, or you can share responsibility with someone else that you trust. And you have to think carefully about how much you actually trust them and how reliable they actually are. And that's all it is. And so there's no like ideal solution where nobody is responsible. It has to be somebody, and it has to be you or somebody you trust, or some group of people that you trust. And if you're using collaborative custody, you're sort of expressing trust, or at least, yeah, you're expressing trust in like that society will continue functioning in a favorable way for people like you,
Yeah.
And that might be
That's not a gamble. I feel like taking these days.
Well, no, but I mean, Right. But again, like, I don't want to over-optimize for paranoia either. It's like quite likely that, you know, things will be fine, I think. I'm fairly an optimist. I mean, I think I'm like a prepper, but also an optimist, which maybe makes me weird. But, you know, I think you do your preps, you prepare, you make sure that you have enough food and water and so on. And you make sure you have Bitcoin that's not KYC'd, and you make sure that you can access it with nobody's permission. And then when you're done with all of that, you need to stop worrying so much and like go live your life. And if you want more Bitcoin and it's like you want it in a retirement account and you want it to be tax advantaged, maybe you go do that, you know, because you've already prepared for the worst and now you can prepare for the best, you know? What do you think?
I agree. I think we get caught up in, you scroll Twitter long enough, you listen to the wrong, sometimes very interesting, but the wrong podcasts and people, and you just think the world is all chaos. In the meantime, until it's not, or until it is all chaos, we should live our lives and enjoy it. And I think people just need to weigh those trade offs. I do want to get I could talk about self custody all day. I want to get back to some of your opinions on some things, because so the recording's going to come out post inauguration. You talked about Trump's crypto project, this nonsensical little thing that he's doing, and the way it distracts from Bitcoin.
Yeah.
I'm personally of the belief that we are not about to have our first Bitcoin president. Like, I know people say that. I think we're about to have our first president who isn't going to screw with Bitcoin and there's not going to be an Operation Choke Point 3.0, which I think is very valuable. That's not a necessarily a criticism, but I think it'd be generous to describe him as a Bitcoin president. What was the point you're making in this piece, and what do you think the implications are for the Trump administration related to Bitcoin policy?
Well, I think, you know, it's not clear to outsiders who are new to this space what the distinction is between Bitcoin and crypto. And they sense that there's something there that people are very opinionated and passionate about, but it's a bit of an esoteric topic. It's hard to learn that, right? You have to, you know, 100 hours of study and so on, or whatever it is now. And so I don't know that the Trump administration, you know, his kids, which I think Eric and Don Jr. are the ones that were launching that initiative. Frankly, I haven't heard anything about that initiative since the launch.
Yeah, me either.
Yeah. So like, I don't even know that it's an issue.
There's an ordinals thing going on though now.
There's
Did
an
you
ordinals
see that?
Thing.
Yeah. Which to me is a shit coin on Bitcoin.
Okay, it is, but it's like incrementally better, right?
he's heading toward the right protocol,
yeah,
I guess.
Exactly. And so maybe that's, you know, I think I wonder if part of this also is sort of the tendency to want like to moon. And people are realizing that, you know, the Bitcoin, you know, 1000x return, if it's really now to the point of sort of broader adoption by TradFi and you know, maybe that kind of return isn't available on Bitcoin. I mean, even if it went from 100,000 to $10 million a coin, that's only 100x, which sounds, only 100x, that's insane. But it's not Shiba Inu, you know what I mean? It's not like this.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think there are some people who are like, I want to put it all on black, you know, win like on a level that, you know, no one could even comprehend. They just have like these like fantasies about riches. I think that's part of what's going on. It's like, there's probably some understanding in the administration that Bitcoin is different. It's a commodity. It's the reliable one. It's the one that's the future will be based on. But there's all these people passionate about crypto who want to like donate money to us, and they're all rich and they got rich on all these coins. There's got to be something there. DeFi, all this stuff. So I think it's just like people who aren't well versed in this world are just grappling with conflicting messages coming from different interest groups. And you're just seeing sort of the other side of that on the output.
Do you think Bitcoin is something he will get? Like, is he going to grok Bitcoin in the next 4 years?
Grok Bitcoin. I think it's like, I think there's a world where they, I think they just continue down the path they're on, which is they think that Bitcoin is a commodity. Even Gary Gensler said Bitcoin is different on his way out. Like, I just saw this news yesterday. So Bitcoin is different. And, but we also want to be friendly to the crypto industry because, you know, there's a lot of money and projects and interesting work going on there. And so, I think they'll grok it to that extent. I think they'll understand that it's like not a security and that it's a neutral monetary settlement layer and that kind of thing. Yeah, I do. One thing that I've been talking about with my friends that you might be interested in is, and I want to ask your opinion on this. Do you think that there's a danger that the protocol of Bitcoin will be attacked by TradFi and that it will result in an eventual like soft fork?
What is there a particular like end that they're trying to achieve that you have in mind?
I think it would be, they're looking at it and saying, okay, every time we settle, we have to pay this much money. So we want less money. So we're going to figure out ways to change the protocol to make fees lower. And then they might want to mess around with supply, right?
Supply would be a hard fork though, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I could see a contentious battle over a hard fork, you know, if they want to go to 42 million coins. Mm-hmm. I think that sort of thing is, I don't know that that would be like a base case for me. I think it's certainly a possibility. They're going to want to control the protocol. The problem that they're going to have is early in the short term, it's going to look like they're winning because so much Bitcoin is locked up at Coinbase in particular, and then I guess Fidelity and maybe a couple of others. And I think those big players are going to be the ones who have the ability to make the call for which fork are we following. And they're going to follow the fork, obviously, that they've, you know, voted for, 42 million coins, let's say. And I think the rest of us self-sovereign types are going to just ignore that and continue with BTC as we know it today. So real Bitcoin doesn't die. It will win in the end. It could really, really throw some confusion into the market, slow thing, you know, this seemingly upward trajectory that we're on could be hampered.
Yeah.
But I think 100 years from now, I think BTC still wins because I think it's, I think what people ultimately need, whether they realize it today or not, is reliability and consistency and certainty about what the supply is going to be. And if it's BlackRock's fork, you really want those guys controlling it? Or maybe we can all just decide, like, we're one big HOA. They're trying to be the federal government playing monetary policy.
Yeah.
So that's kind of my take. What do you think, what do you put the probability of something like some sort of fork like this taking place in the next couple of years being?
I mean, you can't underestimate the egos of some of these personalities, right? Yeah. Like, they think they run the world, these people at the top of these big TradFi firms, and how politically connected they are, and they're kissing the ring of, like, the new administration, and the new administration will want to do them favors back, and won't understand, like, the gravity of what they're up to. And so I actually think it's non-zero. I would put it at 23%.
I think you're somewhere in the right range of likelihood.
But if
I don't
that
think
happens,
it's,
though, we all get rich, right?
We get to
we
double
all
our coins.
Double the coins, and then we all just sell them and go buy real Bitcoin with the money. The nice thing is that there's, like, you know what's actually, thank God, I never thought I'd say this, but thank God we had Bitcoin Cash because it makes us fearless. Like, you know that a true attack, one where it, and back then, like, history turns out a certain way. I don't believe the arc of history bends towards justice, which is something I think Obama said. I don't believe that at all. Like, things go really, really wrong. And so that could have gone the wrong way. Like, back then, Bitcoin was in danger of dying, and it would have been a failed project, and it would have set us back, like, hundreds of years in, like, civilizational progress towards towards settling the solar system. So like, we made it through the skin of our teeth. I don't think it was destined to be that way. And so, you know, it's sort of tempting to be like, oh, Bitcoin Cash happened. And if BlackRock coin comes and, you know, they'll just learn the same lesson. I hope so. I think that's probably right. And I think part of the reason that that becomes more likely is because we have the Bitcoin Cash experience and we have extremely high conviction about changes to Bitcoin being undesirable in almost all cases. But it does, I wouldn't want a hard fork to happen. I agree with you. It would be like disruptive. And if I could choose one or the other, I wouldn't be like, let's have a hard fork and then we all get double the coins and then Bitcoin still wins. I think it's too risky and disruptive, and it will cost a lot of people a lot of time and money and a percentage of their lifetime, because they will not benefit from Bitcoin, which I think everybody could. So yeah, I hope it doesn't happen. I don't think it will happen, but you can't underestimate the size of these egos, you know?
Yeah. No, I think if in that sort of situation, and I feel this way anyways, you know, people are so excited about, like, I was listening to Jeff Ross on a podcast this morning, and he's a cautious guy, but he gives us price predictions. He thinks 475 by the end of this year. I think what people, I think he said it in this interview, and it was a really important point that people miss. And that is, he's like, I don't think much about the bull run top. I think more about the bear bottom, because he's like, you need to mentally prepare yourself, your business, whatever, for 70,000 in 2026. Mm-hmm. He's like, yes, that's great, and maybe it means you can do something. But like, if you're just hodling for the next 20 years, mentally prepare yourself for that 475 top that I'm anticipating to be 70,000 a year later.
58K gain.
Yeah. And if we have a hard fork and there is mass confusion, because most people don't even know what that means, I think we need to be ready for $10,000 Bitcoin, cool. You know, and just, I think people need to prepare themselves for that and remember that you're either in it for the long haul personally, or you're planting a tree of which you will not see the shade, and it's for the next generation of family or whoever's in your life. Like, so that's just general that's like my general rule is as I think about it. And part of the reason is I haven't been in Bitcoin that long. I'm only a couple years in, and I remember seeing it get down to 15,000 a few years ago, and I was still sifting through the FUD. Like, I understood it was FUD, but I was like, maybe this, like, yeah, I don't know. This is a pretty big dip. And all the OGs are like, no, dude, this is 15,000 is what we dreamed about 6 years ago. You know, I mean, this is amazing. So yeah, that's just sort of general advice.
Yeah, no, I agree. I like the idea. I've seen these charts that show the floor of Bitcoin and the floor price every year. And it does go up, except I think there was like one exception where there was a down year, right? But that is a way to mentally prepare, is just tell yourself that that's how much money how much purchasing power you actually have. Look at the bottoms. I think that's cool. So 475, interesting. Well, I mean, the other thing you could do is in order to prevent the worst instincts of some of these TradFis is just ensure that Bitcoin's being adopted in other jurisdictions. Because, you know, and that's too bad that that's gone slower than we had hoped. Although there are good things happening, I believe, behind the scenes. We just haven't seen the news. Maybe the new Trump administration's success in sort of advancing a Bitcoin-friendly policy will now encourage some of these other fence sitting jurisdictions to come and say that they're kind of finally pull the trigger on this. You know, it's like game theory. When does the game start? Like, we've been told there's this game theory that's going to happen, but the game seemed to start and then it didn't start. And so I hope that 2025 is the year that we see some of this really happen. Like, I remember I was on a camping trip during the El Salvador announcement, and It's like everybody was beside themselves. Oh my gosh, you know, this is like a domino falling and there's going to be other dominoes. And
very slow domino.
What?
It was a very, very slow domino to fall.
One domino falling very slowly. And so we'll see, you know, I hope that there's some merit behind these rumors that there are other countries that are getting ready to make moves.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the geographical dispersion of Bitcoin adoption is important to mitigate against these types of things, you know, BlackRock stepping in. I mean, BlackRock by itself is bigger than a lot of nations, but, you know, if they're trade partners, people that, you know, or countries that we rely on for certain imports or that we rely on for certain exports, I think that's hugely advantageous. Let me add one more comment too. We sort of refrain from talking too much about price because I think what a lot of people fail to remember, the longer they're in Bitcoin, the easier it is to lose sight of the fundamentals and to look at what's my wealth going to be next year, 5 years from now. You know, if I just hold it, you know, when can I retire? And that's great. But at the end of the day, even if the Bitcoin price drops to $10,000 because of a hard fork that BlackRock tries pulling off or something, don't lose sight of, and this is, I'm saying this, I guess, more to the listeners, because I know you know this, you still have sovereignty over your financial life with Bitcoin. You may not have the same purchasing power today that you had a year ago, but you still have self-sovereignty. You still hold censorship-resistant money that can't be manipulated, that can replace the Federal Reserve in its entirety. And that's a very powerful thing that I think people, it's like, oh, I can't buy as much. It's like, okay, wait it out. We'll get back there. Maybe it's next year. Maybe it's 20 years from now, but wait it out. You still have money that can't be taken from you. You don't need permission to send around the world. And it's really cool. It's a really special thing.
And there's a lot of people like you that have the same conviction, which I think is also something that I want to communicate to newer people. It's easy to think about Bitcoin again as some kind of fringe movement. But when you think of, and then you're like, no, 2-3% of the global population is estimated to use Bitcoin. And by the way, owning Bitcoin is using Bitcoin. I don't want to have that argument again, but like definitely is. And so 2-3% of the world uses it. Oh, that's only 2-3%. That's hundreds of millions of people, right? So there's a lot of people. There's no way that like everybody will wake up one day and go, poof, this blockchain is useless, and now we're going to go do BlackRock, or like, poof, it's $10,000 a coin. Okay, fine. But like, I have a community of people that I can engage in transactions and commerce that are interested in the Bitcoin that I have and interested in trading with me, something that I need. So you're not alone in this, and you don't have to think in terms of dollars. Actually, we should talk a little bit about macro and sort of the economy in 2025, because what we're talking about with price, $10,000, $500,000, we're using, you know, the metaphor that people use is, and I don't know who to credit for this, but it's like a stretchy, it's like an elastic measuring tape. So we think in terms of dollars because it's the standard, but dollars are not one thing. They're constantly moving, and in fact, they're constantly depreciating. And so, you know, that is going to continue to happen in 2025. There are, at this point, so many ways that inflation gets worse that it's very hard to imagine that it won't get worse. Because I was thinking through this, and I may have written about it, I don't remember, but it's like if you think through, if a lot of these radical new policies that Trump wants to implement are successful, they may benefit the United States and benefit the economy and benefit people, but there's still a lot of inflation. And if he fails at it, there's still a lot of inflation. So, so that's why things like 475, okay, $500,000 Bitcoin, okay, but like, are cheeseburgers $80 now? It's like, I don't even know, like, how to think about that. I mean, it's hard to make price predictions when your measuring tape doesn't work. And so 6 months from now, you know, we've had over the last few years 20% inflation easily, and that's only what the government will own up to. It's much worse than that. And then, so think about this. So you have tariffs. Tariffs are inflationary. And especially if you replace income tax with tariffs, you're going to have people in this country having a lot more money that they keep. And then that will put upward price pressure on consumer goods. So tariffs are inflationary, even if they work well, right? And then you have, I mean, you have Janet Yellen financed the government with short-term T-bills. And was she political about that, trying to kind of like put Band-Aids on the economy just long enough for the Democrat cronies to like continue in office? I don't know if that's fair or not. I'm not going to make, you can probably guess my opinion, but but those T-bills are now maturing. And so there's going to be a lot of debt service, and that's inflationary. Even crazy things like territorial expansion, you know, like Greenland or whatever, that's inflationary. So I guess I haven't thought through the numbers yet, but I think 2025, if we have this conversation next year, we're going to look back and be like, wow, you know, the dollar isn't what it used to be. And how that affects Bitcoin, I guess, is yet to be seen. You would guess that hard assets are going to benefit from that. So, you know, maybe it's going to be an amazing way of weathering the storm here.
Yeah. Yeah, there are a lot of ways to think about, you know, the purchasing power of Bitcoin, how the macroeconomic environment shapes that. I think I go back to, because like everything you just said is correct. I try to revert back to maybe more broadly. Okay, let's say there's $500 trillion worth of assets in the world: money, real estate, government debt, stocks, gold, Bitcoin, and then some collectibles. At any given point in the future, what percentage of that, so in today's dollars, call it $500 trillion, is Bitcoin going to occupy? And right now it's, you know, 0.01%, you know, whatever it is. It's, I mean, it's, you know, 1/250th of the world's global wealth, I guess. And I think it's going to be a really slow burn, but I see government bonds and real estate migrating into Bitcoin considerably, but I think it's going to be over the next 10 years. Like the average person who owns a rental property, for example, they're addicted to the cash flow, and they get their tax advantages, and it's like, yeah, but your hurdle rate's 50% to be Bitcoin. Are you doing that? Well, no. And also I have to fix toilets in the middle of the night when they get clogged, and like that kind of sucks. But I think it's just, it's hard to break that mindset, you know? And, that's kind of how I tend to think about, like, what's the price of Bitcoin going to be? It's just what percentage of global assets is it going to eat up in today's dollars? And, I have no idea, you know, like I'm not making a guess here. It's just maybe another way of framing it. And I know a lot of people just talk about global liquidity is really, you know, if there's a lot of global liquidity, we see major pumps in Bitcoin. When it gets, you know, pulled back in.
Yeah,
less,
except that,
you know,
liquidity is, but liquidity is fake. I mean, what I mean is liquidity makes the number go up, but it doesn't increase the overall product
value. Yeah.
But yeah, no, I agree. And sorry, I lost my train of thought there, but
no, I think I kind of pulled us in another direction, but yeah, I was just talking about the way I think about like how to consider the value of what Bitcoin's going to be is,
right?
What do you think it's going to eat up?
Well, actually, what I wanted to, you triggered a thought, which is like, do we need better, we do, I think we need better financial instruments that do enable cash flows from Bitcoin. And I think that that's perfectly possible without like the yield dynamic. And so
you have an example of what you think, like what you're thinking?
Sure. You know, Bitcoin is a productive asset in the sense that it's block space, or it's space on the blockchain or on the ledger. And so there has to be a way of monetizing the certainty of that. And we haven't, you know, it's reasonable to take on some amount of risk if you want cash flows. And so the products that exist today, like Bitcoin-backed loans and so on, are just so poor and expensive that they only have a very limited use case. But if we build more financial infrastructure around Bitcoin, then we should be able to turn Bitcoin into sort of a productive asset that has a fundamental value in terms of cash, you know, discounted future cash flows. I don't have like fully formed thoughts on that. I can't share some of the conversations that we're having, but we are having conversations with some people who are doing innovation in that space, and I'm actually quite hopeful for that type of work, because people do need cash flow, and so the ability to earn things like rent are the reasons that people are willing to go and fix a toilet in the middle of the night. People who want or on fixed income, you know, that's why they buy bonds or dividend stocks and so on. So, you know, I think if we're going to quote unquote replace the financial system, there is going to be that component of it. That's just inevitable, because people will figure out, there's like a whole field about figuring out, okay, how do you take this capital and make it productive? That's finance, right? And it does work. It's just that it involves risk. And the reason it's gotten a poor reputation with Bitcoiners is because today you need to invest money and put your wealth at risk just to prevent yourself from losing money through inflation. And so it's like you're sort of being very unfair to people who just want to live their lives, and they just want to use money because money is a language that they use to transact in. And you're punishing them by telling them that no, like unless you keep learning about new investments and taking risks that you don't understand, you know, basically we're going to just start siphoning money right out of your bank account and out of your house through all the various ways that we know how to do that. And so that's why, you know, finance and risk taking and yield has gotten a poor reputation with Bitcoiners, and rightly so. But over the longer term, you would expect the financialization of Bitcoin to result in the ability of people who choose to put Bitcoin at risk or to take financial risks because they understand them or just choose to do them, that would become an opportunity. So,
I probably tend to part ways philosophically with my colleagues at the Bitcoin Way on this. I think that we live in a highly financialized world. Like, there are a lot of people making really good money and bringing no value to society. I hope that Bitcoin fixes a lot of that, just a lot of the nonsense, and it requires people to bring value. That said, I guess maybe I tend to agree with my colleagues that what I'm about to say isn't optimal, but I think it's coming. And that is, you know, a lot of these solutions like you're talking about. Certain people need cash flow. And I think if you live on a Bitcoin standard and maybe you have a spouse earning fiat, and so like you're able to pay your bills or whatever, but like other than that, you just pay your bills, put everything else into Bitcoin, and you're young. I think that's very simple. But to the point you're making, I'm very sympathetic. My parents are retired, right? Like they do not have cash flow. They cannot pay their bills if they do not have cash flow. And so being 100% in Bitcoin is possible. But if we have a massive dip, if we hit that 10,000, you know, mark because of BlackRock's fork, and they're trying to pay their bills, they're getting rid of a lot of Bitcoin to pay their utility bill, you know, for the month or whatever. Yeah. Like that's just not, it may make you feel good that you're being philosophically consistent and you live on a Bitcoin standard, but it's not the best it's not the most prudent financial move. And so my hope is just on a Bitcoin standard, like on a more global or, you know, a broader Bitcoin standard, that these financial products just become more So you do them, you use them intentionally and not out of speculation because you're falling behind and desperate to make a quick buck, but you're just leveraging this asset that you've found and you use on a daily basis to create cash flow in a relatively low risk way. You know, I think that's, yeah. I don't know exactly what that's going to be. It sounds like maybe you've kind of got, you're having some conversations that make you hopeful that those sorts of solutions are coming. So I'll be eager to see what they are.
Yeah. No, but I think you have it exactly right that there's always this push pull between, practicality and an idealism, and the idealism is very good because it's like pulls people, the whole world, honestly, in the right direction. And without the people with high conviction who are able to make sacrifices in order to advance the interests of everybody through using the Bitcoin protocol, without those people's sacrifices, we would be nowhere where we are today. So we owe people everything who have put themselves at risk in order to do that. Because frankly, the people who held Bitcoin since, you know, many, many years ago, they're a little crazy. Like, that wasn't necessarily a rational thing to do at the time, but it definitely worked out. And because again, I don't think it was inevitable. I think Bitcoin could have been a failed project at several points in its history. And so the people who held through conviction and were just like, you know what, I don't care if it fails, if I lose everything or if I lose this money, I don't care, because like what I believed is what I stood up for. And so we owe them everything. But it's just, and we still need people like that, desperately, but there's also like, not everybody can be a hodler of last resort who could benefit from Bitcoin. And we need to make sure that we're building products for them too.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Well, hey, we're at about an hour here. I want to start rounding the corner. I know you shared a little bit about Coinbits at the beginning, but I want to give you an opportunity to maybe talk about what it is you do, how your users interact with you all, what sorts of, you got some cool features, I think, that deserve to be highlighted. And then maybe anything else that you're working on that you're able to share that people might be getting excited for this year.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, we're known as kind of the Roundups app. We're a website, so we're a web app. So you won't find us in the Play Store or the iOS store, but you'll find us at coinbits.app. And we're a KYC exchange, so you have to go through kind of onboarding. And then the main feature people know us for is roundups. So what that means is you link your credit cards and debit cards and bank accounts. And then when you go about your day spending money in fiat, we're rounding up your purchases to nearest dollar, and we're buying the difference for you in Bitcoin. So it's a fun way. Some people actually, we kind of adopted as a marketing phrase, something that I heard from one of our users, which is that it taxes your short-term spent thinking, right? Or your high time preference spending. So, you know, you go out and you enjoy your $4.50 latte, but you're like, but I am saving 50 cents in Bitcoin, so it's not so bad. So, so that's kind of the original feature. And that's all Coinbase did in the beginning, but we've expanded into just a full featured Bitcoin on-ramp and off-ramp. So you can buy Bitcoin, you can sell, you can deposit cash, you can actually carry cash balance, you can move cash in and out of your bank account with Coinbits. You can set up recurring buys daily, weekly, bi-weekly, or monthly. And then you can also connect a hardware wallet and set up auto withdrawals. We recently released a new feature which we're excited about called Spending Insights. We realized talking to people that they were looking at their Coinbits dashboard to monitor their spending, because your Coinbase dashboard shows you your credit card spending purchases like in a ledger, and for roundups, right? So that you can see like all the Bitcoin that you're saving up. But we talked to people and realized that they were using this as their dashboard for like their spending monitoring. And so we built something called Spending Insights, where we took all those transactions, we categorized them. So and you know, as you know, we work with Safety in the past, and we're really inspired by his model of high time preference and low time preference spending. And so we actually categorize that for you, so you can see, you know, how much money are you spending on low time preference, like things like education, like online courses or gym memberships, you know, things that better you in the long term that may be unpleasant in the short term, but that make you help you reach your goals, so that you can feel a little bit less guilty about that type of spending. And then, you know, the restaurants and the Netflix and the things that you don't probably need, we show that to you in a different category and encourage you to,
you know, so you auto categorize it.
Yeah, it auto categorizes
high and low time preference.
Yeah, and the holy grail, which we really want to build, is the ability to just kind of like move spending over. So it's like, okay, I see all this high time preference spending. I'm gonna click, 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 and I'm gonna just like stop doing that and turn it into Bitcoin. So we're working on that to kind of help people save more. But yeah, like our ethos is all about like personal responsibility and financial planning. And so we've really evolved into a personal financial management app. And we're going to continue going in that direction and really straddle this world. So you have fiat features, because again, you need fiat because you have fiat liabilities, and then you have Bitcoin savings account that you can where you can kind of maximize your exposure to Bitcoin, but then manage how much of each currency you are carrying at any given time. And then also blurring the line between self-custody in a hardware wallet and custodian. Because right now we believe from like a product perspective, that line is too bright and thick, and it doesn't have to be. Like, you should be able to, again, this is KYC surveilled. Okay, fine. But so you don't connect your hardware wallet. That's like the super private one. But there, you should probably nowadays have a hardware wallet that's not private. Because you shouldn't just assume, well, if it's not private, I keep it on an exchange. Like, no, you should still be sovereign over it so that you don't have counterparty risk, even if people know you have it. So you should have that second hardware wallet and you should connect it to Coinbase. And then over the course of this year, what you're going to see is more features to kind of move money seamlessly between your hardware wallet and external counterparties. So, you know, you should be able to see a balance on your Coinbase dashboard of all the Bitcoin, the KYC Bitcoin that you have. But it's a combination of what you keep with the custodian and what you keep on your hardware wallet. And when it comes time to convert that to cash or to send it to somebody over the Bitcoin network, you can do that pretty seamlessly.
Very cool. That's awesome. All righty. Let's, I got to ask the last question of the show. I ask this to everyone. So what is an unpopular opinion that you hold, and you get bonus points if you offend some Bitcoiners?
Well, I mean, I think we already did it, right? It was the idea of financializing Bitcoin. I'm sure that's going to offend a lot of people, not a lot, but certain type of Bitcoiner. That's what I think. I think we're going to see. I think that financial products on Bitcoin, not necessarily the way they've been done, and not necessarily with, you know, integration of new tokens and all this other garbage. No, but financial products that provide people with cash flows on their Bitcoin are inevitable and not inherently evil.
I think that's a good hot take. The one that I remember, I had Stephen Lubka from Swan on the podcast months and months ago, but he was talking about the very high probability of sort of what you're describing here. And another one he mentioned was, you know, bringing lightning liquidity. You know, people want to transact on a Lightning network. They need channels opened. Could you, you know, as a Bitcoiner, provide liquidity and be compensated for that? I don't use the Lightning network enough to know like what sort of return you make on that, but maybe someday when it's more globally adopted. This is such a hard thing for me to respond to, because on one hand, I completely agree with you. I think so much of this is inevitable. I think it can be done well. It hasn't generally been to this point. But I think people just need to, let's just put it this way. I'm not going to be the first person to test the waters with new products, right? Like I'm going to sit back, see who gets wrecked, and then figure out, you know, how I navigate the landscape. So,
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I cannot thank you enough for your time, Dave. Why don't you give a handoff, tell people where they can find you, learn more about Coinbits, and anything else you want to share?
Absolutely. Just one place. Go to coinbits.app, coinbits.app. That's where you should go. Check it out. You can make a free membership and check out the platform. We would love to have your audience give us feedback. We do, with our members, we do live sessions every single week talking to people and learning about what they need. So if you had ideas for what you would like in a Bitcoin platform, if you see a gap in your own experience, you know, we're a small team, we're super fast. So our ears are always to the ground listening to people. So get in touch with me if you have any concerns, questions, ideas, and make that account coinbits.app and start rounding up your spare change into Bitcoin and let me know how it goes.
Fantastic. Dave, thank you so much for your time today, man.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate it.
And that's a wrap. Again, I appreciate you taking time to listen today. I know I enjoyed this conversation. If you did too, do me a favor, subscribe to the channel, give us a like, comment, share it with someone who you think might be interested in it. Really appreciate that. Go check out Coinbits. You can also follow the Bitcoin Way on X. We're at the Bitcoin Way _, and you can shoot me a message there as well at the other M Jordan. If you need help with proper 100% Bitcoin self-custody, go over to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We also help with privacy phones, online privacy, Plan B residency options. Again, thebitcoinway.com/podcast. We'd love to chat with you. Until then, remember, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.